Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This is episode 723. There will be no 724 because I'm in Paris and it's a rerun. So this is it for the week. Enjoy. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Very interesting. Would you like to join the conversation? I'd love to have you. Phone number 8888-ASK-LEO. That's all you have to do. Just call that number and we can talk about tech. Well, it's been an interesting week for net neutrality. We'll talk a little bit about that briefly because it's a little confusing. It's a little complicated. So I'm going to try to make this as simple as possible, but even I find this a little bit opaque. So it goes back to Netflix. Netflix, of course, uses a lot of bandwidth. I saw a stat the other day, something like a third of all the bandwidth in primetime is Netflix streaming movies. Do you do that? You know, where you could do it on a computer, but now they can also do it on PlayStation 3, on Sony's PlayStation 3. You could do it on a Wii. You could do it on Xbox 360. You can do it. There's also a lot of devices like the Roku box. And even nowadays, a lot of TVs and Blu-ray players have that built in as well. And I guess a lot of people, in fact, Netflix changed their pricing structure recently to encourage you to do streaming. A lot of people are starting to say, hey, I don't need a disc anymore. Netflix is that, you know, you disc DVD by mail service. They increased the cost of DVD by mail to a buck more a month. But then they offered a $7.99 streaming only subscription. Now, it should be cheaper because it's not as good as the disc, neither in quality nor in selection. And not all the movies they have on disc are available on streaming. But they like it. Because, well, the movie companies want them to do it, and the movie companies are using all sorts of clever ways to pressure Netflix into moving from a disc-based model to a streaming model. Why do the movie companies like it? Well, because it's harder to pirate a stream. In fact, really most people wouldn't know how to do that. Easy to pirate a disc or copy a disc. In fact, I think a lot of people rent a disc on Netflix, make a copy of it onto their hard drive, send the disc back, and now they've got the movie, right? Movie company knows that. So they say, let's go streaming. We don't have to worry about piracy. Of course, there's no physical media to send back, so it saves Netflix money. They pay the postage, you know, on these. They don't have to buy the media in the first place. And the movie companies have put pressure on the company, on Netflix, by limiting the number of discs they can get of popular movies, by making deals saying you can't have the movie until a month after it comes out on DVD, things like that. They're really putting a squeeze on Netflix. So for $7.99, you get a Netflix subscription. You can stream any movie if you have the appropriate hardware connecting your TV to the internet. People are doing it. Lots of bandwidth. Tons of bandwidth. Netflix used to ride on a content delivery network, or CDN. That's what they call them, CDNs, called Akamai. Everybody, Apple uses Akamai for iTunes. Very popular. Everybody uses Akamai. But it's expensive. It's really expensive for the company, you know, for Netflix. They have to pay for it. So a company called Level 3 Communications came along. They're really kind of not a CDN. They're a little different. I mean, they might beg to differ there, but a lot of people consider them really more of an internet service provider. They say they're a leading international provider of fiber-based communication services. Whatever. They're the bandwidth provider. I mean, if you think about it, Netflix has to have a big fat pipe coming into their building where they have all the streaming. I don't know how they, you know, that'd be really interesting to find out how they do it. Do they have just a bunch of computers with movies on them? They must. And imagine the size of the pipe, the bandwidth coming into that space. That's why they used Akamai originally, because Akamai would have server, you know, a content delivery network typically has servers all over the place. And each server kind of keeps copies of the movies people want, and you get it from a local server. It's faster for you, and it's a more efficient way to distribute this. Level three. And by the way, one of the things Akamai was doing for Comcast, which is the biggest internet service provider in the United States, was delivering the movie close to the subscriber. So they'd get it right to the kind of the Comcast head end right there from Akamai. And that's kind of how Akamai works. If you live in Atlanta, there's a server in Georgia for people who live in Georgia. And in effect, Comcast would get that bandwidth, that data from the Georgia server, and then give it to you. So it saved Comcast traffic on its overall backbone. When Netflix saved money by going to level three changed how this works. According to Comcast, level three said, well, you can come get it. You can come fetch the movie at our head end and transport it over your network to the subscriber. And that's where Comcast said, wait a minute. We want to make you pay for that. Because Akamai used to give us the data right there. And now you're saying, we'll give you the data way over in Los Angeles, and it's up to us, Comcast, to transport it from Los Angeles to Georgia, and then from Georgia to our customer. Well, that extra Los Angeles to Georgia link, that's costing us money. We want to charge you. Level three went, whoa! Comcast putting up toll roads on the information superhighway. Those backbones, you know, that's public property, and they shouldn't be charging us extra. But they said, we don't have any choice because if we said no, Netflix might not be too happy. So level three's paying it, but they made a big stink about it. And they said, this is a net neutrality issue, and this is why it's complicated. Well, who's right here? The way I just described it, which is how Comcast describes it, it kind of makes sense that Comcast would want some more money out of that. They're costing them more. But really, the internet is designed to do exactly that. It's designed to take data. You know, if you listen to this radio show over the internet, and I know a lot of you do, or you watch the video that we stream from my studio, we don't get that data right next to you and then let your internet service provider pick it up. Your internet service provider comes and gets it. That's how the internet works. I can't afford to have a server everywhere you are. So, you know, maybe Netflix can. Of course, I don't send as much bandwidth as Netflix, do I? But in aggregate, there are a lot of little people like us, a lot of little radio stations and radio shows and TV shows broadcasting on the internet. And in aggregate, we're using more than Netflix. So here's the other side of the story. Is Comcast going to come to me and say, Leo, if you want our subscribers to watch your show or listen to your radio show over the internet, you're going to have to pay us extra because we have to carry your show all the way across the country to Atlanta. Oh, yeah. See, when you put it that way, isn't that what they do? That's what an internet service provider does. They have big connections, big backbones. They pay lots of money to Sprint and other companies that own the internet backbones across the country for that carriage. But that's what I'm paying Comcast for as an end user. That's why I pay. What do you pay? $40, $50 bucks a month? For your internet access? Well, that's what you're paying for. Deliver me the bits from wherever they come, whether it's Atlanta, Los Angeles, or Belarus. Those bits are all equal. They're all out there in the internet cloud. And are you telling me I should pay more for bits that come from farther away? Does that make sense? Oh, now it's a little complicated, isn't it? Well, who's right here? I don't know. I could see, you know, level three kind of changed the game. Comcast had it good. Because Akamai was like a bread delivery truck that'd come right to your door. They had a milkman. They're mad because they don't have the milkman anymore. You mean I got to go to the grocery store and get the milk? You're not going to deliver it to my doorstep? I'm going to charge you extra for that milk. What if you did that? What if we said, I have to go drive and get that milk. I'm going to take 5 cents off the cost of that milk, grocer, because you didn't deliver it to me. You didn't bring it to my doorstep. I'm going to take a nickel off because I had to go get it. That's basically what Comcast is saying. I have to go get these bits. Well, I'm going to charge you for that. Now, here's the real problem. And this is really where it comes down to brass tacks. If there were competition for your internet dollar as an end user, if you had several choices, equal choices, then level three could have said to Comcast, sorry, we're not going to pay you. Comcast loses Netflix. Comcast loses you as a customer, right? That's what we need. Some competition. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yeah.
8888. Ask Leo. This reminds me of last night.
We don't need no education.
Thank you, Kyle. I saw one of the best concerts I've ever... I think it was the best concert I've ever seen. Amazing. Last night in Oakland, Roger Waters, of Pink Floyd fame, he wrote The Wall, Pink Floyd album The Wall, 30 years ago. They performed it famously on the Berlin Wall in 84. I guess that was 10 years later in 91. But went to see it, and just an amazing show. I know a lot of my friends saw it in L.A. at the Staples Center, and he's going on. He'll be in San Jose and in Seattle and so forth. But the technology in this show, just mind-boggling. You know, compared to how they did it when they did it first, when Pink Floyd did it first in the 80s, just remarkable. Massive projectors. I think they had 30 projectors across, you know, spoiler alert, there's a wall involved in this. They build a wall during the concert, and they project on the wall, and they had very high power projectors, apparently 30 of them arrayed in 10 rows horizontally, and three per zone to make them bright enough, because of course you're a big arena, giant inflated audio animatronic puppets that are moving automatically. The sound was surround sound. I mean, it was all around you. And they actually moved some of the sound out over the audience. A remote controlled pig blimp floats out over the stage. It's just it's amazing what concert technology has done. Just amazing. If you get a chance to see it, highly recommend it. Very expensive ticket because it's a very expensive production, as you might imagine. Line one, Yvonne, first on the show from La Mirada, California. Hi, Yvonne. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I've got a couple questions for you.
Yes.
I deliver a presentation class in my workplace where each participant is recorded three times delivering 3 to 5 minute presentation. Currently,
well,
I'm using
neat. It's kind of like Toastmasters for your work.
Yeah. Actually, I'm a trainer in my workplace. So I love it. Currently, I'm using a Canon camcorder with a mini DVD player. After each presentation, I must finalize the DVD in order for the participant to view the DVD on a portable player. As a result, I'm using three DVDs for every participant, and it's also time-consuming.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, if this is feasible, to use an SD card camcorder.
Yes.
I could then have the participant take the card and view the video on like an iPad or a similar device. What are your thoughts? Is
that feasible? Do they want to keep the video, or is it just for the class that they need the video?
Well, we need the participant to be able to view the video during...
You understand, but do they want to take it home afterwards?
Well, that's the goal, yeah.
Okay. So, in other words, the reason I ask is they need a copy.
Yes.
And DVD's nice because everybody has a DVD player, pretty much, and they could take it home and use it. Your alternative is to record it digitally onto, as you mentioned, onto memory and give them a file. And you can make that file so they can play it on their computer. You could have iPads if you want, but I mean, you could just give them you might give each participant a USB key with their three videos on it.
Okay. All right.
They're pretty cheap. And it sure saves you a lot of time.
Yeah. It's very time consuming right now.
Yeah. So, absolutely. I mean, most of the camcorders now record onto some sort of solid state memory. Sometimes some of them have hard drives in them. The JVC Averios have sometimes hard drives as well as flash memory. The key on this for you is you're going to have software that can read the format on these cards and edit it easily. What are you using right now?
Well, these are just standard corporate PCs, I really don't do any editing.
Yeah. In fact, you record a DVD and you just give it to them. You probably don't do anything at all.
Right.
Yeah, it never touches a computer.
No.
So what you're proposing is going to require a computer. You might want your own computer to do this, or a laptop or something fast enough. If you're using Windows, Windows Movie Maker will read these files. They're recorded almost always in a format called AVCHD. AVCHD. And in order for you to read it in and edit it, you really want a program that can handle it. Windows Movie Maker is free. Comes with, you know, from Windows Live, get.live.com. And if you have Windows 7 or Vista, you'll have no problem running it. If you don't record in super high, you know, you might have to lower the quality if you have a, if your PC isn't super powerful.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. Don't record in high def then, or record, you know, but that's fine. The DVDs you're making weren't very high quality. It's just their head.
Yes.
Or their, you know, their torso. So quality, I mean, we're not making,
movies or anything.
No. Dr. Zhivago here. Yeah.
Oh, no, no.
So you'll find as you do it, you might, you know, you play with the parameters and record it the best quality that you can live with, but the lowest quality that so that you can edit it fast and the files are small.
Okay, great.
How long are the speeches? 5 minutes?
Yeah, they're anywhere from 3 to 5 minutes each.
So 3 5-minute clips you could fit on, you know, a pretty small USB drive. Probably the smallest you can find would be probably 512 megabytes or a gigabyte, and it would fit on that easily.
Okay.
You can get an hour on the probably the smallest one you could find. So that means, you know, $20. It's gonna be cheaper, and it's gonna be a lot faster for you, because basically you'll shoot the video, you'll take that card out, you'll plug it into the computer. You want a computer that can read an SD card, has Windows Movie Maker. If it's you know, a little bit better quality, be Premiere Elements. That's $80 from Adobe. Max iMovie does it just fine. Read it in. Chop off the beginning and the end. You could put titles. You can make it fancy if you want, and then put it on a little USB stick. I think that'd be the most efficient way to do it.
Okay, great, great. I have one other question if you have a moment.
Yes.
I have 14 voice messages on my cell phone, which I really want to keep indefinitely. What is the reliable means of saving these messages?
Yeah, I get this question a lot, and they're actually, let me see if they're still around. There were a number of services that would allow you to just copy your cell phone messages onto this service and then have you email the WAV file.
Oh.
Let me see if I can find, you know, these, a lot of these were .com casualties. Let me see who's still in business. Yeah, these all look like new ones, to be honest with you. There's one called soundfeelings.com. Let me see. I'm just going to look around. But, you know, you could, of course, hold the phone up to a microphone, but it's a lot easier if you can export existing messages over. And I'm just looking. I'll probably have to do some research, because I don't know if any of these programs are. What kind of phone do you have?
I just have the Verizon.
Just a feature, a standard feature phone.
Yes, it's just a very basic phone.
Yeah, most of these companies that were around, and you know, I notice a lot of them are gone as I look, would tie into your Verizon voicemail. You'd actually replace your Verizon voicemail with this company, and in the process, one of the things it would do is make all your voicemails accessible. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break. I'm going to look. Worst case, you could just plug into your headphone jack and record it that way. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy.
Well, the Tech Guy Show is brought to you by Stamps.com. Why wait in line at the post office this holiday season if you could print your own official U.S. postage from your Windows PC and your printer? You can with Stamps.com. For a no-risk trial offer, including a $100 bonus with $45 free postage, go to stamps.com and use the offer code Leo. Stamps.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, kind of some interesting solutions in the chat room. I've got one commercial company that does this, but they charge you $30 to record your voicemails. It's called Recordia Pro, R-E-C-O-R-D-I-A-P-R-O.com. $30 for 2 hours. That's easy because you do it all from your phone. If you have Skype, you could of course, and this is probably a great idea, free way to do it. You launch Skype on your computer. You need a way to record Skype audio. There's a great solution called Pamela that will do that. Call your voicemail and record the results. That'll work just fine. That'll work just fine. So that's a free way to do it, but it's a little more complicated. You've got to get Skype, and you've got to be able to record Skype calls. Pamela on Windows is a great way to do that. P-A-M-E-L-A. I think it's Pamela.com. Let me see if I can find it. Pamela-Systems.com. You could also use Google Talk. That's a good way. You know, that's a way to do it for free. So if you have a Gmail account, install the Google Talk plugin that lets you make voice calls using your Gmail and Gtalk account. That's actually a thing to do anyway. You're sitting in Gmail and you can answer the phone, you can call. And it's very inexpensive, actually free through the end of the year in the U.S. and Canada. So you'd call your voicemail. You press 4 in Google Talk to record the call. So you record, now you're recording the call, and then you do go through your voicemails one by one, and you've got them as a recording in Google Talk. So a number of good choices out there. Thank you, chat room, for making that that one. If you want to be in our chat room, by the way, go to techguylabs.com. You'll see that's where our show notes are. This is episode 723, so you can get the show notes. James DeRuvo writes those down. We also record the shows and put them out as podcasts later in the week, so you can listen to previous shows there. And you'll see a link to chat and video. You can watch me do the show
from our palatial studios here in Northern California.
Why are you laughing, Mark? Mark and Andrew are visiting the studio. We have an open studio. People come by and visit. And they said, well, where do we sit? I said, well, right here. He says, but you're practically in your lab. I said, well, it's a small studio. It's a little intimate. Just be prepared when you come. Chris, Charlotte, North Carolina, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
That's fun.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
Good. What can I do for you?
I've been watching some netcasts on Twit and Revision 3 for a while now, and you guys have kind of motivated to get into it a little bit myself and maybe do some.
You want to do it? Oh, see, that's great.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that.
Thanks. Couple of questions. You know, we're kind of looking at a format similar to this week in tech where people are going to probably be in different locations.
Right.
So we're going to probably need to use Skype or something else for video conferencing. Yeah. But I'm looking into equipment and just trying to figure out, you know, do you have any suggestions on, you know, good cameras, microphones, or, you know.
I've just spent the last 5 years of my life doing in the field research on how to do this stuff. And boy, did I say 5 years? I also should say a couple of million dollars. You don't have to spend a couple of million dollars. In fact, you could benefit from all the money I've spent.
Excellent.
Make it easy for yourself. What is your subject?
Well, probably going to be tech. You know, and in the IT world for about 15 years.
Good. Self and some of the. Yeah, this is the neat thing about, and you know, you call it netcasting. I think that that's the right term. It was podcasting, but I think that's a terrible term because it implies an audio program that you download and put on an iPod. And
yeah,
that isn't by any means what we're limited to anymore. Basically, it's internet broadcasting. It's a show on the internet, and it could be audio, could be video, could be both.
Right.
You could put it on your iPod, but you can watch this, and many of our viewers watch it live on the internet on a web browser. So, or on their phone via, there's many Twit applications. Twit's my network.
Mm-hmm.
Where's that coming from? Unplug that. I'm hearing myself. His iPad is starting to play back. So here's the deal on that.
Mm-hmm.
You said you want to do video. It gets very complicated, very expensive, very quickly if you want to do video. Are you set? Is your heart set on that? Because what I would suggest is do what I did, which is start with audio
Okay. And
work your way up.
Okay. No, I mean, our heart's not set on that. And just since we were going to be in different spots, I thought it would be.
Yeah. So what we did, get ready. We built something we call Colleen, my chief of engineering, former chief of engineering. She's now at Google. I like to think she's at Google because of the great job she did here. Built something she called Skypeosaurus. Skype now will let you do multiple people, you know, video conferences. At the time, we could only do one at a time. So we built a machine that was four computers, four screens, but made to look as one. And we could then have four calls with video going on. And in some ways, that's still the best way to do it because you can separate each channel. Each picture is different. But Skype does now allow you to do video conference calling. It takes a lot of bandwidth. Have you tried it?
We haven't tried it with multiple people. I mean, I've used Skype.
Yeah, Skype one-on-one is a miracle. And that's what we do, essentially, is every time I have a contributor on the show, we call them via Skype. And we get a beautiful picture from them. They usually, most people now have cameras on their laptops. That's more than adequate for this. I do recommend, whether you're doing audio or video, good audio is so important. I do recommend going out and having everybody spend $30 or $40, that's all, on a USB headset. The Plantronics .audio 655 is the one we use right now. It's about $30 or $40. It's USB, not analog. That's really important.
Right.
Because you want it to be USB into the computer, because computers tend to make noisy connections. My experience is much easier. Okay. The Plantronics is a headset. It's designed for Skype calls. It has a little microphone and good earphones. It's very comfortable. They can wear it for, some of our shows are 2 hours long. They can wear it for 2 hours and not feel discomforted. It has a real advantage for non-professionals. One of the tricky things when you're doing radio, and really this is radio with pictures, is keeping your guests on microphone. But the headset mic moves around with them as their head moves around, because people like to look around when they're talking.
Right.
That doesn't work. Radio people are used to talking into the microphone. I mean, but your hosts are not pros, so it's good to have a headset. So I would say give them a headset mic. Let them use their laptop with the camera. That's adequate. If you want to step up the quality of the camera, we found that the Logitech QuickCam C510, which is $60, is amazing.
Okay.
Really good, even in low light. More light's better, so get them to turn on the lights. We do a lot of, when we have a guest on, we do a lot of pre-fine-tuning. We'll say, when I had Steve Martin on last week, I said, okay, now aim down so we want your head at the top of the frame, not in the middle of the frame. You want to make sure you don't have a light behind you. This guy's made many movies, so I think he knew enough not to have a window behind him. You want to have the light shining on your face, not behind you. You'd like a simple background, and you'd like no motion in the background, because Skype is doing a lot of work to compress that video. The more motion there is, the worse it'll look.
Right.
And you want them to kind of hold still and shoot themselves kind of chest up. Again, less motion is better. If it's a static head and the only thing that's moving is the mouth, Skype's going to do a great job.
Now, what about software? I mean, I've kind of found the software called VidBlaster.
VidBlaster's fantastic. Highly recommended.
Okay. Excellent.
Another good one is Wirecast.
Wirecast, excellent.
These are great programs that basically turn your computer into a television switcher, like a real TV production uses. This is what's exciting about this. You can do 90% of what they do on, say, Meet the Press with off-the-shelf hardware. You have free distribution over the internet using YouTube or Ustream. We use Ustream for the live stuff, or BitGravity or Justin.tv we use for the live stuff. All of these are free.
Right.
So, you've got free distribution, very inexpensive gear to make this happen. You could do a network television show for nothing. And that's what's very exciting about this. Hey, Chris, good luck. Call me back when you're going. We'll give you a plug. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Consumer Reports, Dr. Mom in the chat room telling me Consumer Reports just came out with their recommendations, their holiday recommendations. And instead of recommending the iPad, Dr. Mom, was this for all purposes or just for e-books? They recommended I think a really surprisingly good device, which is a Samsung Galaxy Tab. This is an Android device, not an Apple device. Some people say, I don't like Android. It's not as elegant and beautiful. The form and fit and finish aren't as good. The applications are not. In fact, I think my friend Andy Yanako, who writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, said, the problem with Android, it just looks like they spewed controls all over the screen and they don't make any sense. Okay, fine. If that's what you want, get an iPad. I don't have a problem with that. But I have to say, I'm a big Android fan, and the variety and choice of applications is excellent. It's fairly mature. It's ironic because Google themselves said this version of Android is not our tablet version. And yet, in my opinion, it is. It's a perfectly good, accomplished tablet. Has many of these same apps, you know, because Android is so big right now. I mean, it's in fact growing much faster than the iPhone and represents a good chunk of the smartphone market, maybe as much as a third of the smartphone market. There's all the apps that you'd want are on here. I mean, there's no lack of that. Android, I think, is in some ways has an advantage because it doesn't have the Steve ruling on everything, you know. So there's more variety in some ways of applications. Some that, for instance, like Google Voice, that just recently appeared on the iPhone, tightly integrated in with this. Now, the weird thing about this is it feels like it ought to be a phone. This is the Sprint version. Verizon and AT&T and T-Mobile all have their versions. It does have Sprint 3G, but it feels like it ought to have a phone. I know it's not a phone. I mean, it's big for a phone. You wouldn't want to look dorky holding it up to your head. But yet, you put some headphones in here, it just feels like I ought to be able to make phone calls on here. Anyway, I have to say, I don't have a problem with the iPad. In fact, I love the iPad. I think it's a great device. This is roughly the same cost, and you have to buy a two-year contract with the phone company. I do think there are going to be Wi-Fi versions of the Samsung Galaxy Tab, but I don't know if they're out yet. They pulled them back off the market. It's a great choice, I think. Very good choice, especially if you know you're going to be using 3G. You know, it's less expensive. I think it's $25 a month for the 2 gigabytes a month. So it's not hugely expensive. But I kind of agree with Consumer Reports, mostly because I'm surprised. I just didn't expect much from this device. I really didn't. This is the Samsung Galaxy Tab. I have the Sprint edition, but they're all virtually the same from all the carriers. The iPad's going to be a big seller this Christmas. You know what the big seller is, though, for the holiday season? Faster than the iPad. Maybe it'll slow down because there's a limited market. I don't know. It's the Microsoft Kinect. If you have an Xbox 360 and you don't have Kinect, you've got kids, you've got a family, you've got social life, you're not just playing Call of Duty every 5 minutes, you know, this is a great choice. I really like the Kinect. $150. It's an add-on for Xbox. If you don't have an Xbox, a lot of people, I guess, are getting Xboxes with the Kinect. It's already, in the first month, 2.5 million units sold. That's faster than the iPad sold. 2.5 million units. Very good choice. We've mentioned also the Roku. If you don't yet have your television hooked up to the internet and you don't have a way of doing it, you should check. Your Blu-ray player may do that. Most do. Your television may even have an Ethernet jack in the back. A lot do. But if you don't, and you want to watch streaming Netflix on your big screen TV, the Roku is a great way to do it. And they're on sale. I think they range from $69 to $100. And I thought a very nice choice. So there's some good gadgets out there. It was interesting because I saw the stats for Cyber Monday and Black Friday and the big, you know, online purchases. Black Friday was huge for online purchases. Cyber Monday is kind of a made-up idea. We've talked about this before. The theory of Cyber Monday was people would see all the Black Friday sales. They'd go out and physically buy stuff on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. But they would wait to get online till the following Monday when they could go to work and use the fast internet connection at work to do their online purchases. Well, come on now. Everybody's got a faster connection at home than they do at work. Almost everybody, right? So I don't think people wait to go to work on Monday to make their online purchases. And in fact, Cyber Monday is only the third largest online retail day. There's two more coming as we get closer to Christmas. Hanukkah's on right now. I'm sure people are doing Hanukkah purchases too right now. So the day after, the Monday after Thanksgiving is not the biggest day of the year by any means. Nevertheless, I saw a statistic that said most of the online purchases that occurred last week weren't gifts. People were buying for themselves. Isn't that interesting? I'm going to get this Galaxy Tab for me. The heck with my kids. This is for me. I'm not sure why that is, but I don't know if that's atypical, but a lot of the online stuff last week was personal buying. They saw the great sales and they said they'd buy it. Tell you another great gift, if you have a reader in the family, is the Kindle. $130 for the Wi-Fi only version. And frankly, that's fine. You don't, unless you travel a lot and you know you're going to want to have the WhisperNet, the 3G wireless on it, which costs more and drains the battery. Get the $130 Wi-Fi version. If for a reader, it's amazing. Especially a reader who travels and wants to carry 100 books in a device that weighs just a few ounces. And is easy to read. It's easy on the eyes. Dennis, Santa Monica, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for your help today. And also, thanks for your suggestions on Christmas gifts.
Oh, I'll have lots more over the next few weeks.
Cool.
You're welcome. But those are, actually, I just gave you my top, the top five. I probably should have stretched that out a little bit.
Well, it's good stuff. I'm the guy who called before working on my backup plan. I have the two IBM ThinkPad laptops, mm-hmm. and I'm switching between the two. Well, you recommended SyncToy as one solution, which I think
free Microsoft program. It's yeah, it does a very good job of synchronizing two drives.
And the only downside is you can't schedule it, but that works okay for me because I'm not going to. I have to do it manually anyway with two laptops.
Well, you know, the funny thing about SyncToy is it doesn't have scheduling built in, which is a definitely a missing feature, but you can use the Windows scheduler to schedule it.
Oh,
so
okay.
You can schedule, and that's if you read the limited instructions, they'll say, yeah, here's how you do it. But Windows scheduler is the worst. I can't believe Microsoft hasn't improved it over the last five versions of Windows, but it's pretty much the same as came out with Windows 3.1. But you can use it, and what you'll do is you'll schedule the launch of SyncToy and the running of SyncToy, and you can schedule it just as you would anything else. If you want something that has schedules built in, I really like Second Copy by Centered Systems. Very similar.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not big on scheduling, but
That's right. You said you don't need it, but for people who want it, Task Scheduler built into Windows will do it.
Okay. Oh, well, let me get to my question here.
Sure.
I discovered that I like to type a lot, and the faster I type, the more mistakes I make. So I really like, in Word 2003, this tool called AutoCorrect, and I discovered I've created a large AutoCorrect library of words, and then the issue comes up, well, if I'm going to sync it with my other laptop, then how do I migrate the settings? So I checked the Microsoft knowledge base, you know, support knowledge base, and there's actually a document on that for both Word 2003 and Word 2007, but it looks long and involved, and I'm thinking maybe there's an easier solution as an integrated backup solution, backup synchronizing solution, and so I thought I'd call you about it and see if there is.
Yeah, really, all you're going to do is back up the AutoCorrect library, which is a dictionary. And if you search for files, I think that it's the only thing I know of with a extension .acl for AutoCorrect Library. So basically back that up.
I can't just use SyncToy, you think?
Yeah, you can. Just tell SyncToy this, back this up.
Oh.
But you have to find it first.
Okay, so I just have to
find it.
And, well, way cool.
Yeah, I'm not sure where it's stored. You know, it could be in various places. Let me see if I can find on the internet a magic place that they store it. I imagine it's stored in a variety of places. But do a search on your hard drive for .acl. That'll be your AutoCorrect library. And wherever that is, you just tell SyncToy, keep this synced. That's the idea. And synchronization is a very useful tool for backup. I actually set it up this morning. I'm going away on a long trip, 5 days in France. And I thought, you know, I really ought to back up everything before I go. And I'll tell you what I did when we come back, because it's time for a break. 8888 Ask Leo, that's the number. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. This portion of the Tech Guy show is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the easy way to make a professional-looking website. Just go to Squarespace.com, use the offer code Tech Guy. You can try it free. You don't even need a credit card for 2 weeks if you decide to buy. 10% off for the life of your site. I really like Squarespace. You want to try this. Squarespace.com, hosting plus software to make gorgeous sites easy. Use the offer code Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888. Ask Leo. That's my number. Dennis is in Santa Monica, California. Hi, Dennis. Oh, wait a minute. We were talking to Dennis before about autocorrect.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. Yeah, go ahead.
I saw a suggestion online from geeks.com that I should be using, well, besides backing up to an external hard disk drive, they also suggested partitioning your hard drive for your laptop, putting the operating system on one partition and your apps and data on another. Do you suggest that, and how should I go about doing that?
I mean, it's too late once you put stuff on the drive. Partitioning erases everything on the drive unless you use a non-destructive partitioner. And it's not such a finesse. It's not such an important thing to do that I would run out and buy software to do it. When I set up a computer, I almost always do that. And on any operating system, separate data from the operating system. And if you think about it, it's just easy. It's an easy way to protect your data so that if, for instance, you have a problem with a system and you maybe you get a virus on it, you want to reinstall Windows, you can wipe the drive, reinstall Windows, and your data is intact because it's on a separate drive. It's the same physical hard drive, but a separate partition on that drive. So it looks like a different drive. So I usually have a C drive where Windows and applications live, and a D drive where I put the data. On Linux and Mac, I do the same thing. I keep them on separate drives. That way you can wipe and reinstall the operating system on the C drive and not touch the D drive. It also makes it easy to back up. You just back up everything on the D drive. You do have to change Windows a little bit to make this work. For instance, you have to change where your documents go and settings and all of that stuff. And you can do that pretty easily if you right-click on your My Documents folder and select Properties. You can change on any modern version of Windows. You can change the location. So you point to your D drive and say, store everything there. I think that's a good idea on most operating systems. You really want to get fancy, and again, this is a finesse, but when I set up a new system, I generally will do this. I have a third drive. It's actually the first partition I make. It's a small partition just for the page file or the swap file. That way the swap file isn't anywhere, near my data. It doesn't fragment the drive. You might even want to set up a temp partition for temp files. And this kind of slows down fragmentation. It kind of isolates temp files and swap files, which you don't want to back up anyway. So if you really want to get fancy, you partition the drive with an S, partition first. The reason you put it first is that's the fastest part of the hard drive. It doesn't need to be big. Typically, twice the size of RAM is sufficient. If you have 4 gigs of RAM, make it 8 gigs. Make a gigabyte temp file partition, or you could even make it bigger. Now drives are so big, it's no big deal to take 4 gigs for temp files. Then make your C partition for Windows and your D partition for data. It's a finesse. It's not going to make a huge difference. I think the biggest difference is that your data is separate from your operating system and apps. So if you have to reinstall, you don't have to worry about your data. That's the big difference. Sam is in Cardiff, Wales. Hey, Sam. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
I phoned a few weeks back asking about the Android recommendation.
Yeah, did you buy?
I got a Samsung Galaxy S in the end.
Good choice. Very nice phone. Do you like it?
Yeah, I love it. It's brilliant. I love Android. But there's a problem. And I'm following Samsung on Twitter, and they've said that FroYo 2.2 will be rolled out through November. And like every phone should be offered it by the end of November.
Yeah, and it still isn't.
I go to Samsung Keys, which is like the iTunes, like the multimedia management center for it. And basically, it says this device's firmware cannot be upgraded.
So they're not going to update it?
They're just not offering an upgrade for me. like, you know, to 2.2.
That's your carrier, because, of course, that phone can absolutely be upgraded. And you do want 2.2. 2.2 is really the most recent version of Android. In fact, 2.3 is supposed to come out pretty soon. That's Gingerbread. They name them after desserts. So the current version of Android, the Android operating system, is Froyo, after frozen yogurt, and it's 2.2, and you really do want that. You have 2.1, which I think was Eclair. Let's see. Yeah, it's alphabetical, so it would be E for Eclair. So you really, I mean, it's nothing, it's not bad, but Froyo is much faster, and it's certainly tastier. No, it's not. It's faster, though. I think if you go out and Google Samsung Galaxy S, you will note there are many people out there who are making versions of 2.2 for your phone. It's your carrier that's decided not to do that, by the way, not Samsung. Whoever your carrier is, for some reason, has decided not to update. That's a mistake. Here's why this happens. And people have complained about this. Oh, the fragmentation in the Android market. Well, it's kind of, it's something that goes with the way Android is set up. Google created Android. Actually, it existed. Google basically bought it, brought it on, and created something called the Open Handset Alliance, which a number of manufacturers are members of, including Samsung, Motorola, HTC. And they opened it. They made it open source, which means anybody can download the source code and build it into their phone at no cost to them. Google, on top of that, does some Google applications like, say, Google Maps, Google Mail. All of that is proprietary, owned by Google. But the base operating system is not, and can be modified by anybody. Google's slow to release the most recent version, though. They only recently, about 3 months ago, released the source code for 2.2. So this is why a lot of handset manufacturers only now are putting out 2.2 on their Android handsets. First, Google had to release the source code. Then they had to adapt it for their phone, particularly for the specialized software that they put on it, and then test it. And once it was safely tested, they put it out. So most phone handsets now are 2.2. There's been enough time elapsed that they could do that. When Google puts out 2.3, only the Google phones will get it initially. And then once they put out the source code, the other manufacturers will modify it, test it, and put it out on their handsets. So there's always this lag. The big jump, though, was 2.1 to 2.2. You really do want 2.2. They made some major speed and reliability improvements, and 2.2 really makes a big difference. In fact, if you're going to buy an Android device at this point, I'd say, don't buy it unless it has 2.2 on it. And you want some assurances from the either the wireless company or the manufacturer that they plan to go to 2.3, to Gingerbread. The next version, H, is Honeycomb. That'll be 3.0, and we don't know when that's going to come out. That's the one Google says really should be on tablets. So I know all this is confusing, and, you know, nobody really worries about this stuff on other phones. Oh, do I have the latest version? The truth is, this is kind of a side effect of being so open. Because it's open, because anybody can do it, there's differences in the timing for different companies and different handsets. That's just kind of, unfortunately, a side effect of being open. If you tightly control it, like Apple does, well, there's only one company that makes the phone, and there's only one version of the operating system, and that's that. It's consistent. It's simpler for the buyer, and for many people, they prefer that. But there's no choice. On the Android side, there's many, many, many manufacturers, many different form factors, many different kinds of hardware. You know, it's interesting. Microsoft has kind of the best of both worlds with their Windows Phone 7. They said the hardware has to be this, but they have a number of manufacturers. So you do have a choice between physical keyboards and on-screen keyboards. They all have the same processor, different amounts of memory, all the same camera. And there's one version of Windows Phone 7. So Microsoft, I think, looked at Android and said, we could do this better. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This portion of the Tech Guy Show is brought to you by my good friends at Citrix, makers of GoToAssist Express. If you are in support, you need this tool. GoToAssist Express, try it free for 30 days. Just visit GoToAssist.com/Leo. You might as well jump. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 88 to ask. Leo, John is in Los Angeles, California, listening to the great KFI, our mothership. Hello, John.
Hello, Leo. I have a question for you about getting my internet access wirelessly. And I'm thinking that there might be some hidden bandwidth caps that I should be aware of. Do you know of
that? Yeah. As far as I know, all of the carriers offer unlimited bandwidth as long as it's less than 5 gigabytes.
Right.
Now, I don't understand. You know, cell phone companies, I don't know how they get away with this stuff. You know, they charge you for quitting. If a dry cleaner said, if you said, I'm going to go to the dry cleaner across the street.
Oh, that'll be $175.
What?
Early termination fee, dude.
No, I just want to. But no, and this is even after you've long after you've paid for your handset. I understand they need to recoup the cost of the subsidized handset, but long after that, they're still, you know, change your account, no problem, got another 2 years. So this is one of the really bizarre things. Unlimited is not unlimited. I guess maybe the theory is, well, nobody would ever use 5 gigabytes in a month. So, in effect, it's unlimited. Except that, yes, we do. We nerds use a lot. PC Magazine just reviewed the new Verizon LTE, which is coming out in 38 cities by the end of the year. This is their new high-speed fourth-generation wireless. And the reviewer pointed out that you can go over the 5-gig cap in half an hour.
Oh.
So, these caps don't make a lot of sense. I do understand that the data from a cell phone is very different than data from your cable modem or your DSL provider. They have to get the data out to that cell phone tower. Every tower has to have its own head end. The bandwidth is shared among as many people as on the tower. So there are, it's not the same. There are real constraints there. Most of the providers now offer, 15 for 250 megabytes. So if you're really a light user, that's enough. $25 for 2 gigabytes. And some of them still offer, the $60 a month for 5 gigabyte unlimited.
Huh. Okay. Well, 5 gigabyte, I have a problem in my head figuring out how much I'm using. And
how do we know? Most phones have a usage, will tell you how much data you've used. So if you've been using a smartphone for a while, it's easy because you just look at that.
Right.
If you're brand new to this, you don't know. I would say you can do some math. Email and web pages really aren't going to add up to much. In order to get to the 2 gigs or 5 gigs, you've got to stream video.
Right.
Or download big files. most people are not going to, in fact, use that much. In fact, what the companies, I think it was, I can't remember which one it was, but said that like 99% of their users never get anywhere near 5 gigabytes.
Right. So, and the things I'm talking about are they wireless hotspot or a thing with
right.
five computers hooked up to it?
Yep.
Yeah.
Then you might, if you start doing that. If you're using it, and this is, I think, what the whole thing is about. They really don't want you to make it your main internet connection. If you're using it as your main internet connection, you could conceivably go through 5 gigabytes.
Right, yeah. Well, I got they put a cell site 2 blocks from my house just recently. Maybe that'll be a real good, clean connection.
It should be. Because you're close to it. So that's one of the factors in speed. Also, how many people are using it. So if your neighbors are all using it, then it wouldn't get great speed.
Right.
If you, for instance, stream my video, Bamalam's pointing this out in the chat rooms, and watch this show, if you watch it for 5 hours, you're done. So it's not hard to go through 5 gigs. I don't think that, and I think this is their intent, it's a good idea to use it as your main internet service provider.
Right.
Now, there are deals out there. For instance, Virgin Mobile, I should say, offers a very inexpensive 3G card, like this card you're talking about. They call them a MiFi. It basically uses 3G bandwidth for a wireless access point. And theirs is $40 a month. And they say unlimited. And I think in some cases when Sprint says unlimited, they're the last ones that still offered kind of really unlimited. I don't know if they have still, maybe the chat room knows. Do you know offhand if Virgin Mobile in the U.S., when they say unlimited, it's unlimited? Because that would be awesome. Yeah. And the other thing is that they don't necessarily do the accounting perfectly. Right. So sometimes you can get away with it. I have, in the past, done more than 5 gigabytes without getting paid.
Yeah.
Or having to pay. Well, now, Sprint does offer on the 4G network unlimited right now, but that's kind of promotional.
Oh.
And most people, you don't have 4G where you live. Most people don't.
Right. Right. Well, that answered a lot of questions. Can I switch and give you another question? I was watching your netcast, and you showed a panorama that you shot with your iPhone. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
What app does that?
It's brand new. It takes a little playing with. It's from a company called Occipital, and it's called 360, and 360, maybe 360 View. So what you do with it, it's really kind of remarkable. What you do with it is you hold your camera up. It'll give you a wireframe. You can actually do not only a 360-degree panorama. You can shoot high and low. You can do a whole sphere around you. But it's a little interesting. The way you do it is it gives you this kind of wireframe, and you slowly pan around. And you have to be very careful. It doesn't stitch exactly. It's a little bit of a weird app, and I found that I had to play with it quite a bit before I got good results. The other problem with it is no one can see it. When you save it to your iPhone photos, it's just a flat 2D panorama.
Right.
But if you upload it to the Occipital servers, and if you go to my Twitter account, twitter.com/LeoLaporte, you'll see the 360 pano I made from last night's concert. You have to actually go to the Occipital site where they have a 360 viewer. But it's pretty amazing. It's a fun app to have. I think it was a couple of bucks, $3 maybe.
Right. So do you know if there's a way, like if you want to put it on your own website, is there a way to edit it or just put it?
I don't know. You know, usually when you see these 360 panos, it's done in QuickTime. I would have to go to that's a good question. I'll go to their site and see if I can find out. It probably says something at the Occipital site about how you could embed this.
Yeah.
Because, if you don't embed it, all people get is a very static kind of traditional panorama.
It's a lot more exciting when it's full screen and
it's awesome, isn't it?
And then
around. Yeah, I really I just had a lot of fun with it. Especially for an event like that. Now, one of the reasons I downloaded it and I've been playing with it is I'm going to Paris tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I thought it'd be kind of fun to take some pictures of City of Lights at Christmas time, maybe the Champs-Élysées.
Look forward to seeing it, Leo.
Hey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a neat app. Let me look at this website. 360 Panorama is the name of it from Occipital. And see if they have a player. This portion of the Tech Guy Show is brought to you by my internet service provider, DSL Extreme, for high-speed internet at an amazing price. Call 866-2-GET-NET to get DSL Extreme. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. I just posted on my Twitter account a panorama of the studio. Just to give you an idea, you can see Mark and Andrew in there sitting in the studio. So if you go to my Twitter account, you'll see there are two links. There's one to a TwitPic, which is just basically a static 2D version of it, and then the 360-degree panorama at occipital.com. I think it's kind of fun. The application's on sale right now for 99 cents. You see, there's some stitching problems. Stitching is how this works, where you take a bunch of pictures and you put them together into one large picture, and you can see in a few places there's just some little stitch errors here and there. But it does a fairly good job. Now, the key when you're taking panoramas, this is a good thing to know, is that you don't want to rotate. You want the camera to rotate. Every lens, every camera, every phone has an axis that it needs to rotate around for a perfect panorama. Many cameras, especially high-end cameras, will actually have a mark on the camera, a little red mark that shows where the pivot point is on that camera, because a lot of pros like to do panoramas. On a camera phone, of course, there's nothing like that, but just pretend you've got a pole going up through the middle of the phone and rotate the phone around that. It's a little tricky to do. Don't rotate yourself. If you rotate yourself, it won't work quite as well. But rotate the phone and try to keep it, you know, horizontal or, flat. Don't tilt it back and forth. Now, this app does allow you, and if I can take another picture and we'll see how it works, to paint kind of a larger view. But I found that it looked kind of odd when I did it. Maybe I just need to practice more. But a kind of a fun app. Eli, Tucson, Arizona, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Eli.
Hey, Leo. I found it pretty interesting what you had to say about net neutrality earlier. But another
I know it's complicated, but you could see there are two sides to that argument.
Yes, but another thing that I just ran into in the past couple days are insane licensing agreements between content providers and content distributors.
Tell me about that.
About 2 years ago, I bought the first three seasons of Star Trek Enterprise on Amazon's video on demand service. And I was deployed to Korea for about a year, so I wasn't able to access it over there, you know, international law and all that stuff.
Oh, that's interesting. So you Amazon wouldn't let you watch it there.
Correct. I didn't have a problem with that. The problem I'm having now is that now I'm back stateside and I want to watch it. Apparently, Paramount said, no, you guys don't have the license anymore. So nobody who bought it can watch it unless they had it downloaded previously.
That's appalling. Paramount's, you know, notoriously picky over their Star Trek franchise. And I guess I can understand why. It made them a lot of money.
It's a shame, seeing that I'm a diehard fan for it.
Well, and that's, yeah. Don't get me started. DRM, digital rights management, that's what this is.
Yes.
Is something that any company that creates expensive product like movies, television show, even records, often insists on. It's in the book industry. You know, audiobooks are copy protected like crazy. Copy protection is a form of digital rights management, but you're encountering kind of another form of digital rights management where it's not only copy protected, but it has a licensing mechanism. And this is why you couldn't watch in Korea. In order to watch it, you have to actually go back and check the license servers.
Yep.
And the license server sends you a token saying, yes, it's okay to play this. So that's why you couldn't play in Korea, because the licensing server said, wait a minute, his internet address is in Korea. Then Paramount comes along and says, yeah, we don't want you to watch it anymore. So
even
now the licensing server sends back. Yeah, of course you did. But you didn't. And if you look at the agreement carefully, you'll see they've got weasel words in it.
Yeah,
you probably
didn't buy it
outright. You leased it. You rented it. And time's up, dude.
Yep.
And Isn't that awful? Yeah.
It's like, and they wonder why people buy used DVDs or download it from torrent sites.
Well, and this is something that I got to keep saying this over and over again. Maybe it'll sink in. I think they're not stupid. I think they even know this. But the truth is, the competition is really the pirated stuff. When you copy protect stuff, all you do is push nice people like Eli, who is serving our nation. He's a Star Trek fan. He paid for the content. And then you say, sorry, you can't have it. All that does is push people like Eli into either learning how to steal it by, you know, copying somebody's DVDs or, you know, downloading it via BitTorrent site from the Pirate Bay or somewhere like that.
Not that I have, no.
No, well, you know what? I would forgive. To me, ethically, I think you could. And I think you'd ethically be in the right. Because you paid for it and you never got to see it.
Agreed.
So, I mean, let's ask an ethicist. I don't know, but it sounds to me like they owe you one.
I think.
But what happens now is you learn how to do that. You go, boy, that was easy. And, you know, the quality's pretty good. And I don't have to worry about a licensing server. I can watch it in Korea. Maybe I should do this from now on.
Yep.
So it really breeds exactly what they're trying to fight. It teaches people how to do it. Now, look, Eli, you're a good guy. I consider myself a good guy. I believe in paying for content. You know, somebody works hard to make something that's really great, and it's fans usually that really you know, say, I want to pay for this because I love it. But it's often fans that end up getting taken by this because they're the ones who are reluctant to do what the, you know, lesser fan will is willing to do, which is steal it.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
it's really
I'm not pissed.
The fans that get messed up by this. I know. I think you raise a really, really good point. I really do. This is why copy protection doesn't work.
Yeah. Agreed.
I'm sorry, Eli. I don't know. There's literally no solution. If you look at the agreement, I'm sure it says somewhere in there, there's some lawyer words that say.
I looked at it, and it does say that the licensing can go at any time, and yep. We don't, you can't.
No guarantees.
Like, awesome.
Yeah, isn't that nice? Something to remember, anytime you're buying protected content, you're playing it at the, on the allowance of the company that owns it. And at any point they could say, never mind.
Yeah.
Never mind. It's really terrible.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Leo.
Sure. Thank you, Eli. And you see, I admire him because the temptation. And in fact, I think you would feel in the right doing this is to go out and say, well, I bought it. I never got to see it. I'm going to go get it. And they've been shutting down the Department of Homeland Security. I don't know how this has to do with Homeland Security, but apparently the Department of Homeland Security has decided that pirate sites are a threat to our security, and they've been shutting them down. They shut about 20 down last week. They don't really shut them down, by the way. The sites continue on. All they do is block your access to them. They hide them, in effect. If you knew where the site was, you could go get it. It's just that the DNS entry no longer works. You can't look it up in the global phone book. That's all they've done. The site's still there, still operating. If you knew the address, you could go right to it. Outside the U.S., you can go right to it. I feel much more safe and secure knowing that the terrorists can no longer pirate music or something. I'm not sure I understand exactly why this is part of the Department of Homeland Security. It in my opinion, all it succeeds in doing is teaching people to steal. It doesn't prevent piracy. It doesn't shut this stuff down. And really, it's frankly our federal government doing the bidding of the recording industry. And of the motion picture industry. That's all. They paid, they paid for the politicians. They get what they want. Doesn't work. It doesn't work. And yet, folks, you got to pay for your content. You got to pay for it or we won't get any. Nobody will write a book or make a movie or write a play if they don't get can't make a living at it. So we have to find a solution. We really do. I think we're paying more for content than we ever have before, don't you? I certainly do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. I want to thank my friends at Fezorama.com for making me the world's tallest fez. They're great. It looks a little silly when I wear it. Looks like I look like Zippy the Pinhead because it's like twice as big as a normal fez. But it's cool, and it's got a tassel to match. 8888. Ask Leo. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536, toll-free from anywhere in the world. Actually, toll-free from anywhere in the U.S., but if you have Skype out, you can call that toll-free number free from anywhere in the world, if that makes sense. I certainly hope it does. Argan, Vancouver, Canada. Hello, Argan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Let me tell you, I'm originally from Turkey, and I would like to tell you that we really do not have this there.
I know. Didn't Ataturk kind of ban the fez for a while?
That's what he did. Yeah, he banned the whole thing.
But did it come back after him, or did nobody wears fezes anymore?
I'm pretty sure that there's a lot of people that would like to see it come back, but it's not back yet.
I got my first fez a couple of years ago in Cairo, and they do wear them in Cairo still.
Yeah, I think they do, yeah.
So I'll say this is an Egyptian fez. Actually, it's not. It's, you know, the whole fez thing in the U.S., I think comes from the tiki bar movement. From, and I don't know why it has anything to do with a tiki bar, which is a Hawaiian thing. But, you know, that's us in the U.S. We're just mutts. Well, it's nice to talk to you, Argan. What can I do for you?
Hey. Hi, Leo. Okay, Leo. The question today I have is that I'm trying to shoot a video off the iPad screen.
And oh, good luck.
The results are not making me happy. At best, they look like me, which is not good.
Yeah.
I have a piggy bank looking nervous sitting next to me. And so I'm trying to find out what I can do.
Apple, now, getting video into the iPad is easier than getting video out of the iPad. Apple does make a VGA adapter for the 30-pin connector on the iPad. But programs have to specifically write to it. And, you know, it doesn't just take the screen. It only works if a program says, oh, there's a VGA adapter. I'm going to send the video out. And a lot of programs don't yet.
Yeah. But, Leo, I'm trying to shoot a video off so the video can see my hands.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, so what you'd like to do, and we did this, by the way, for our iPad Today show. I do a show called iPad Today. Sarah Lane and I do it.
Can I see that?
Yeah. Result. And initially, that's what we did. And what we did is we jailbroke the iPad. This is what you have to do. We jailbroke the iPad. And then you use a program called DemoGod on the iPad. And it will play out. But it's not very fast. I think it does it over the network. I can't remember if we used the VGA adapter. Maybe we did. But the quality's not great. I was very disappointed by the quality. You can get the iPad screen. It's kind of, you know, kind of a little bit fuzzier than it would be normally. There's no hand in it, which actually is kind of weird because, you know, when Steve Jobs does it and he touches something, there's a little circle that goes, bleep, you know, bleep, so you can see where the finger's touching and stuff. When you do it this way with the jailbroken, there's nothing. You just kind of, it's somebody's magically operating it. So we actually abandoned it. We stopped using it because we decided we didn't like the fact that it's not as high quality, and we didn't like the fact you couldn't see the hand. So now I just shoot it. I have a camera, and I just shoot it. And if you watch iPad Today, you'll see my big fat man hand going around there. But it seems more natural. You can get a much better shot by shooting it with a camera. We put the camera up high, so it's shooting straight down at it, and you get a much clearer shot. And the finger actually kind of helps because you go, oh, I see what he's doing. He's touching that. He's moving that. He's sliding that. He's pinching that. And so you, in a way, I think you need it. Now, there is obviously a way to do it because Steve Jobs does it at every keynote. He's done it with the iPhone at every keynote. Apple's never told anybody how, and no one's ever figured it out.
Well, I'm okay. That's what I tried to shoot the with a camera.
Yeah.
But I can't light it right. I mean, so you basically put it up high, put the camera up.
So, yeah. So here's what we do. Then I'm in a lit studio. It's lit for television. It's not very brightly lit, but it's lit. I did a couple of things. First, I put a glare coating on the iPad screen from iluv.com. And I did that because, you know, the iPad screen is very glary. It's a glossy screen. And so that's problem number one, is that it you'll see your face or you'll see a light or you'll see something in there. So I put this I Love screen, and it's basically a diffuser. Frankly, I wish I didn't have to, because when I use the iPad, I prefer the glossy screen, but I sacrifice for my art. So I have the I Love on there. We don't light it because it's light coming off of the screen. So what you really want to do is shoot a camera straight at it. It's got to be, you know, parallel to it. Doesn't have to be going down. It just depends on how you want to hold it. I put it on a stand that's at an angle, and the camera's at an angle, but it's perpendicular to the plane of the iPad. It has to be as perpendicular as you can get it. You also want to set the camera's brightness. And if you don't have a camera that you can do this, that could be why you're having trouble. You need to set the camera's brightness a little lower than you would for just shooting the room, for instance.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the camera I have shoots, you know, it has, you know, aperture controls and stuff.
Right. You want to turn off, if you can, you want to turn off any automatic light metering and manually stop it down. So it's you'll see when the iPad looks perfect. It's much darker than it would be because the iPad's bright. It's shining into the camera. So you don't need to light it. In fact, probably the best way to shoot it would be in a dark room.
But then I can't see my hands.
Well, that's, yeah, we don't do that because also we don't want to sit in the dark doing our show. So
yeah.
I shoot it. If you watch iPad today, I think the shots look great. I've been very happy with the shots.
I know. That's why I called. Like, you know, these guys know how to do this.
Well, we're using a fairly expensive Canon camera, GL2. It's a semi-pro camera. But I think most, look for a way to manually set the iris, set the brightness. And we focus, you probably all manual focus it too, because in fact, you may see this on the show sometimes, it's automatic focus and it's not good because it'll pump a little bit when the screen goes dark on the iPad. It says, what am I focused on?
Yep.
So you want to kind of manually focus it. We should be doing that. We're not. And there's reasons we don't. Sometimes I want to put the iPad closer to the camera, so I'll actually physically move it closer, and the autofocus helps with that. You can do it. You just play with it. I thought, you know, at first we jailbroke the thing. We got all sorts of fancy doodads, and it looked terrible. And I ended up just shooting it with a camera because you do want to see the finger, truthfully.
Do you suggest like a longer shot or as close as I can get?
It's pretty. It's about 5 feet away.
5 feet away.
Yeah, but that's just how I do it. I zoom in to fill the frame. It won't fill the frame exactly because it's a 4x3 frame, and we have a wide, as I imagine you do, we have a wide shot.
All these things like green screening and all that stuff.
No. Well, and you know, you're like me. We overthink this stuff. I want to do an Android show, and what I do want to do for that is a green screen of my head. So it's just my floating head, my orb, my pumpkin floating on the Android screen. I thought that'd be kind of fun, but it's so complicated I haven't done it yet. What's your show going to be about?
Well, it's not a show. It's a demo for an app. So.
Okay. No, it's your app.
It's my app, yeah.
What's your app?
Well, it's not out yet. It's going to be a web browser called Caravan.
Awesome.
And it's still in the, it's still waiting for review. And what it is, actually, may I talk about it?
You can if you hold on. I got to take a little break here, but I would love to hear a little more about it. And I'd like to hear about the experience of developing for the iPad. That's kind of cool. We do have to take a break. And before we go to your local news, I want to remind you that an antivirus is key if you use Windows. And if you're using Windows, you need .32. That's as simple as that. Sure, they're free antiviruses. They're not as good. They're not as fast. They're not as lightweight. They're not as effective. .32 is super effective. That's why CNET just gave it 5 out of 5 stars. That's why it's been so highly rated everywhere. Not just viruses, but .32 protects you from worms, trojans, spyware, adware, phishing scams, even rootkits. All the little bugs and beasties that can bite you. Nowadays, more than ever, you need .32 and its advanced heuristics that look for virus-like activity even before the signatures are there. It's really good. Try it free for a month and you'll see what I mean. ESET makes it. That's the name of the company, ESET. Go to ESET.com/Leo for a special deal. You use Windows, you need .32. www.eset.com/Leo. Argon, hang on. I want to find out what it's like to develop for the iPad. And take more calls at 888-88-ASK-LEO. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This portion of the Tech Guy Show brought to you by Carbonite. It's backup done right. You got to back it up to get it back. And the best way to do it automatically through the cloud with Carbonite.com. Try it free for 2 weeks. You don't even need a credit card. Just my name, Leo. Carbonite.com. Offer code Leo. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. of A. Tonight, I am flying to Paris for a French conference about the internet. It's called, get this, Le Web. I can't wait. I can't wait. It's going to be a lot of fun. Loïc Lemur does this every year in Paris. He is a French entrepreneur who lives and works in Silicon Valley. He owns Seismic. You probably heard of Seismic. It's a really great client for tweeting and twittering and Facebooking and all of that. S-E-E-S-M-I-C. I use it. And Loïc puts on this conference every year inviting American entrepreneurs to Europe to meet European entrepreneurs. And there's usually several thousand European entrepreneurs. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And I'm just setting up. You know, this is when you travel, it's kind of part of the fun of it, especially if you have a smartphone, is kind of real-time updates for your friends and family, Facebook and Twitter and all of that. So I'm, you know, I'm setting up my blog and so forth. That's why I've been trying out these camera apps, and I'll be using that 360 Pano app. That's pretty cool. There's some really good. One of the nice things about the iPhone is the new iPhone 4, as lousy a phone as it is a really great camera. It's as good a camera as it is a bad phone. It's only 5 megapixels, but, you know, that's plenty if you have good quality software, and it does. Built in, fairly good lens, and then, boy, the variety of apps that you can use. I'll probably use Auto Stitch for my standard panoramas, 360 panorama for my wide-angle panoramas. I'll be geotagging my photos with a program called Geotag Photos, because I'm going to bring a regular camera, too. But if I run the geotag in the background on the iPhone, it creates a track of my locations that I can then apply to the photos I take so that they'll all be, they'll have longitude and latitude in each photo. That's kind of cool. Pro HDR is an HDR app that does a better job than the built-in HDR on the iPhone. Although the iPhone's HDR is kind of handy. There's a tilt shift generator I might play with. Color Splash is fun. It makes everything black and white except what you'd color in so you can kind of control what people look at. There's, of course, Photoshop Express. Lets you, you know, crop and play with the different effects. I'll probably be uploading to my Facebook, but also to Twitter. There are a number of applications for that. Recording video, too. All of that will be on my blog, leoville.com. You know what I like to use? And I've used this when I was in China a couple of years ago, and it worked really well. You know, I couldn't tweet or Facebook from China. They blocked Twitter and Facebook. But they didn't know enough to block a free blogging service called Posterous, P-O-S-T-E-R-O-U-S. The idea of Posterous is you can email it. See, they can't block email. So that you can email it, your anything you want, text, pictures, video. And then Posterous not only creates a blog out of that stuff, but also will send it on to your personal blog or to YouTube or to Twitter, wherever you would like that content to go. In fact, it's smart about it. You can say, if I send a video, put it on YouTube. If I send a picture, I put it on my blog. If I send text, put it on Twitter and my blog. You can actually control it in great detail like that. So I'll probably use Posterous to get pictures up on my blog and so forth. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to it. If you want to follow along, leoville.com, L-E-O-V-I-L-L-E.com. And I'll be doing a panel with a couple of very well-known European entrepreneurs. The founder of Meetic, which is the number two dating site in the world, partially owned by Match.com, which is the number one dating site in the world. The founder of Meetic. And then the founder of a couple of British startups that are huge. So I'll be doing a little panel. You can watch that. We'll stream it live at 9 a.m. California time, noon Eastern time at live.twit.tv this coming Wednesday, if you want to watch that. Brett Hoberman, founder of MyDeco, and Mark Simoncini, the founder of Meetic, and I, and Loïc Lemur, the founder of Seismic. We'll all be talking about the difference, this should be interesting, between the American entrepreneur and the European entrepreneur. They're a little more laid back in Europe, a little more quality of life. Argan is a Canadian entrepreneur via Turkey, and you're writing, Argan, a browser for the iPad.
A browser for the iPad.
Now, First of all, let me ask you, when you start writing a program for an Apple device, does it worry you that you don't really have control whether it'll get published or not?
Actually, it does, because I did not state how long this project was going to take in the in the beginning, and it ended up taking about six months. So now, if I get rejected and I don't get published, it's gonna be hurting.
No kidding. I mean, 6 months of your life, and you're kind of in all of it, kind of speculative because you don't make a penny until you can sell it. Are you gonna sell it or give it away?
I'm gonna sell it. Well, hopefully, I'm going to sell it.
And by the way, this is a non-trivial choice. Of course, you can sell it, and people do make a lot of money. My friend Lisa Bettany had an application that she created with some programmer friends, a photography application, really good one, called Camera Plus for the iPhone. Made $500,000 in the first month. Then Apple yanked it, and it's off, and it's gone. But at least she made her money, you know.
I know.
But you're at the mercy of Apple. Now, they did something. They broke some of Apple's rules. And I presume, Argan, that you've looked very carefully at Apple's rules to make sure. One of the things that would make me nervous is in the past, Apple has said, we don't want to publish applications that duplicate functionality we have built into the device. And there already is a browser.
Yeah, my worry is about that. My browser is pushing their human interface
right
a little bit. Right.
They're very finicky about that because they want to provide it, and understandably, they want to provide a consistent experience for their users.
Yeah, but what happened? I mean, I looked at this from a user point of view. So I went out, the iPad was out, excited, and bought the magical device, brought it home, and I saw the magic. But then I realized to actually make the magic, you need the skills of David Copperfield. Because there's a multitasking.
there is now, of course, multitasking, but there wasn't at the time. Yeah.
At the time, there wasn't. And basically, I thought, hey, I can carry this so I don't have to carry a backpack full of my laptop and the cables and the power bar and everything. So when I'm out for the day, I can carry this. But then I realized because I can't do what I need to do because of the lack of multitasking, I found out that I'm carrying the iPad and the laptop. And the
right.
iPhone.
Right. Right. By the way, if you're going to write a program and you want to make a living in tech, this is absolutely the best way. Scratch your own itch. Write something because you want it.
So I said, I'm going to make myself for myself. I didn't even think of, I was
right.
a full product at the time. I said, I'm going to multitask. What do I need for multitasking? What do? I need my email. 80% of my life goes on the web, so I'm on the browser. And if I get my email on the browser, on a window next to what I'm actually looking or reading or going to respond, I'm set. So I said, okay, I will write a browser app that allows multiple windows.
Mm.
More than one, more than two, more than, as far as it's going to go.
So we're running out of time, but it's going to be called Caravan. You have submitted it, right? You're waiting now.
I'm waiting. It's the waiting game.
How long have you been waiting?
1 week. So
oh, that's not too bad. I'm crossing my fingers for you, Argan. I will look for it, and I'll tell you what, I will download it the minute it's available, and if I like it, we'll review it on iPad today, and maybe we'll get you on the show to talk about it, because I think it's a fascinating thing. This is, you're an individual. You learned how to write this stuff. You wrote it. You created something great.
Yep.
And now it's as if you're backstage waiting to find out if you've been made Miss America or not.
Yep.
Good luck, Argan.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Caravan, we'll look for it. Leah Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. If you've got a question, a comment, a suggestion, I'd love to talk to you. I always enjoy talking about this kind of stuff, whether it's computers or the internet or cell phones or camcorders or MP3 players or home theater, anything with a chip in it. Valerie is in Pasadena. She's got a question for the tech guy. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm sorry. I just had to pull over real quick.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, no, safety first. That's very important.
Yes. Oh, yes. First of all, I absolutely love your show, even though I don't have a lot of tech sense.
Good.
But I'd like to know if you have looked at the Pan Image tablet that's just come out.
What's it called?
I believe they're calling it Pan Digital.
Pan Digital. Is it an iPhone app?
No, it's not. It's an iPad-like device.
Oh, the Pan Digital. I know what you're talking about. Yes, no, don't get it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's essentially an e-reader. And in my opinion, the best e-reader out there, it's very simple, is the Kindle. The Pan Digital runs Android. It's really inexpensive. Now, I've used Pan Digital frames, and I think they're okay, but I really am nervous about these iPad clones.
Okay.
So my strong recommendation would be if you want an Android device, go with the Samsung Galaxy Tab. More expensive, but I think better. Usually what happens is these inexpensive ones, they don't put enough memory in, they don't put enough processor. It's exactly like a netbook. It's a slow, inexpensive e-reader. The 7-inch Samsung Tab is more expensive, but I think better quality. And then the other choice would be if you want an iPad, get an iPad. There's nothing, it runs iOS. It's the only thing that runs the Apple operating system. 250,000 apps available, probably more than that now. I think better. The Pan Digital is trying to capitalize, frankly, on the success of these devices, but it's made by kind of a smaller company with, don't stay away from it. Do yourself a favor, especially for a gift. You don't want to give somebody a headache. Bruce, Apple Valley, California. Hi, Bruce. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How are you, sir?
I am very well. How are you?
I'm okay if I can get this computer going.
Oh, what's the problem?
Okay, I have a Toshiba laptop. It's a model A105, and I lost my backlight. I have no backlight in the laptop screen. However, you can see everything there. The icons, when it comes on, you can see the mouse move.
Sure. But you have to kind of shine the light. You have to tilt it so that the light shines into it.
Well, I tried that with a flashlight, and it works. However,
this is a fairly old laptop. It's about 5 years old, 6 years old.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So the way an LCD, a liquid crystal display, works is the liquid crystal part is just, in effect, a shutter. There's a bunch of cells containing a liquid that has a very interesting property. When it's charged, when you send electricity to it, it effectively becomes clear. And when it's discharged, it becomes opaque. Behind this film of liquid crystals is a light. So think about it. I charge the crystal, it becomes clear, I see the light. Now, how do we get color? Well, the crystals can have filters in front of them, red, green, and blue. They're very small. You combine them, you can get every color in the rainbow. Just by opening and shutting these little crystals, liquid crystals. They're actually, it's an interesting molecule. They're twisted. And when you charge them, they twist the other way and they become transparent. So the light is very important. It's backlit. It has a light behind it. Now, on most laptops for many years, these were fluorescents. Certainly on that Toshiba, it's a fluorescent. Nowadays, we're using LEDs. They last a lot longer. They're more consistent, even more even light. And in fact, you can even put more of them in, you've probably noticed on older laptops, there's kind of bright areas, there's hot spots on the edge of the screen. That's because that's where the bulb is. But on LEDs, you can spread them out more, and as a result, have a much more even lighting and much higher quality screen. I like LED backlights. Well, what happens when your backlight burns out? And that's what happened. It's a bulb. It's a complex fluorescent. It burned out, or the connection, the power connection, got frayed and frazzled. And if you think about it, the lid of the laptop, after 5 years, it's been opened and closed about 1,000 times. There's little ribbon cables that connect that thing. Could very well be the cable that provides power to the fluorescent bulb is frayed and broken. Can you fix it? Well, are you a handyman? I wouldn't put any money into this A105. It's not worth more than 50 or 100 bucks. So if you put if you brought it to somebody and said, yeah, I could fix that for $200, it's not worth it. So maybe this is a good opportunity. A couple of things you can do. You can go out and buy replacement parts. It's kind of like pick and pull. If you go on eBay and say A105, find somebody that has an A105 that the hard drive died, but the screen's still good. You could just put a new screen in or put a new bulb in. You could do it yourself. Not easy. Non-trivial. Wouldn't recommend it. But you don't want to pay for it to get it fixed. Be cheaper to get a new laptop at this point and be a lot faster. So that's what's happened. The bulb is either burned out or the power cable. Now, if it's just the ribbon cable, that's a fairly easy fix. You can do that pretty easily. If it's the bulb itself, I say, give it up, Bruce. It's over. Put that laptop in the paradisiacal fields where it belongs, romping and playing with other old laptops, laughing and singing, playing the harp because it's dead. Anthony, San Francisco, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, you know what? Before I, Anthony, chat room's pointing out you could, of course, hook up an external monitor. Most laptops of that vintage have a VGA adapter. What am I saying? In fact, I did that myself. My daughter dropped her laptop, smashed the screen. I wasn't going to replace it. We just hooked up an external screen to it. Absolutely. Hi, Anthony. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Good to talk to you, Leo.
Thanks for calling.
So, I'm a first-time caller. I'm very nervous for some reason.
Oh, don't be nervous. It's just you and me and a couple of million other people. It's not. No, it's a small audience because we're just nerds and we're all alike.
All right.
We all wear our pants too high. We button our top buttons and we've got black glasses mended with the masking tape. So welcome to the club.
So I'm a researcher. I'm a professional researcher. I'm looking for a survey that I could use. Something I was, you know, my first impression was the iPad. But
what do you do with it? What do you need to do with it? Do you need a data entry?
Yes, I actually do. But I want something very light that I can walk around. I don't want to lug around my laptop and do these surveys.
Now, if price were no object, I would get a MacBook Air.
That's the other thing I was thinking about.
If you could afford $1,000 for this device, that's it. I'll tell you, data entry on the iPad, because it doesn't have a real keyboard, depends how much data you're entering, but it's not as easy as an actual keyboard. The MacBook Air is light. It's thin. It's what I'm taking to France. I'm not taking a big laptop with me. I'm taking a MacBook Air, but it's $1,000.
$1,000. And
I'll give you another choice if you want Windows that is not $1,000 and is a very good choice, but we'll do it after the break. Talk about a tease. I'll be back. At 33 after the hour with your answer. Show brought to you by my internet service provider, DSL Extreme, for high-speed internet at an amazing price. 0866, the number 2, get net to get DSL Extreme. As I mentioned later today, I'm flying to Paris for a conference, Le Web, and I'm using this as an occasion to talk a little bit about some of the tools I'll be using. There's a website I love called TripIt, and I have been a TripIt fan for years. I am a TripIt Pro member. Well worth it. If you travel at all, the way TripIt works, you can forward your confirmation emails to TripIt, and it will build you an itinerary. And it does a very good job of reading these emails. So it's got my air, it's got my hotel, it's got my my rental cars. It'll send me. It builds the itinerary to include maps, weather forecasts. It's just a really handy way. And then there are applications both for the iPhone and Android that allow you to call it up. In fact, when I arrive at the hotel, I'll be showing them the confirmation right on my iPhone. So that's very handy. TripIt added recently, I think this is probably only for TripIt Pro users, the ability to scan your Gmail account. Now, you may be concerned about privacy. I don't know if you want to let it do that. I do because I don't care. But I don't even have to forward any plans anymore. The plans come to my Gmail account. TripIt looks at my Gmail periodically and sees them. So it kind of knows about everywhere I'm going to go ahead of time. It's got all my travel. If you travel more than a few times a year, it's certainly worth it. I really enjoy TripIt. So there's another little travel tip. I also been setting up with a Lufthansa service called My Sky Status. You can have your Twitter friends or your Facebook friends notified as you travel. So I have it set up so that when I get on the plane, it says, "Oh, Leo just got on the plane." When my flight departs, it says, "Oh, Leo's flight just departed." Midway through any flight over 4 hours, it'll say, "Leo's over the North Pole right now." And then when it arrives, and this is great for family and friends to kind of keep track of where you are, it does it right to the Facebook account. Or I'll send an email. That's a free service from Lufthansa. It's called My Sky Status. Just a couple of cool ideas. Now, we were talking before the break with Anthony, and he is doing field surveys. So it's like the census, Anthony. You ask people a question, they give you an answer, you have to enter into a computer.
Yes.
So light is important. But also, the ability to enter in data easily is important. You know, a lot of people for years used this. This was kind of one of the chief uses for tablet PCs. You would hold it and tap it. And the iPad, I think, is equally good. Do you use special software, though, to do the data entry?
Well, there's not really. We do have an account with, like, SurveyMonkey, and so...
Oh, okay. So a browser would be enough, then.
That would be enough, but, you know, I on the other hand, I do my own stuff, too, where I don't, you know, I kind of do other surveys, and it's not going to be put on SurveyMonkey for the other employees to see.
So, and you could use a website, though, or some other way to do that. You could even just use a word processing document. And the reason I ask is if there's specialized software that's Windows or Mac, you'd have to have a desktop for that, unless they made an iPad program. I think I would look at the iPad a little lighter, but I think if all you need is a browser, just as good in this case, smaller, lighter, is the Samsung Galaxy Tab. I really like that.
About that in an earlier phone, and that was comparing it to. Because I really like the experience, and I think people will like the experience too if I handed them the device and it was touchscreen. It's kind of cool for them to...
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it would keep them more engaged. I just wasn't sure of the experience. If they did have to type something in on a touchscreen, it's a little...
I think it's pretty usable and in some ways less intimidating than giving them a laptop.
Well, that's true. That's very true.
And by the way, it's kind of, it looks like this is a device designed to do this. I mean, it doesn't, it's not a, here, can you type this in on my computer? You're saying, here's our special survey device.
Ah, that's very true.
Right. I like the Galaxy. It's exactly the same price as an iPad. It's about $500. You do have to sign up for a 2-year contract with 3G, but you need 3G. So that's okay.
For the Galaxy?
It's the same for the Galaxy, and it's the same price 3G as the iPad, $25 for 2 gigs.
And they run on Windows. They use Windows.
No, Galaxy Tab is an Android device.
Oh, it's Android. Okay. Okay.
2.2.
There was one more.
Battery life would be an issue because the iPad is 10 hours, and it really is a real 10 hours. You could take it out all day. The Galaxy Tab is more like 5 or 6 hours.
5 or 6 hours. Hmm. Okay. Does the Galaxy have maybe even an app for scanning the documents? That's the other thing I might.
You bet.
It does. It does have that.
You bet. Okay. Now, one of the best apps I've ever. Now, the problem with the iPad for that is there's no camera. So you're out of luck with the iPad.
I thought the updates that they were going to do, or they haven't.
Maybe. I don't know. Apple doesn't tell me, and they don't tell you, and anybody who says they know is making it up.
Oh, man. All right. Oh, that's...
And anyway, if they do update the iPad, it won't be until April.
Oh, all right.
I mean, I'm assuming that they're going to do the yearly updates as they do with the iPhone.
Yeah. Hmm.
So I wouldn't wait for a camera at all. Now, an iPhone might be a choice for you. In fact, there's a really great application on the iPhone that lets you take high-quality scans of documents. It's almost like the idea is almost it's like a scanner application, but it uses the iPhone's camera. And the iPhone 4 camera is so good that this actually is a pretty good technique for getting data into your iPhone as if you were scanning it. The Samsung has scanning applications, or you know, you could just use photography applications. I would probably use Evernote. If I were you, I would use Evernote, and that will just sync up. It'll scan it in. They do some limited character recognition, and the camera's not as good as the iPhone 4 camera, but it's good enough probably, as long as the text is fairly clear to get an image.
Yeah, I tried. I have an old 3GS iPhone, and I'm actually calling from it right now. And I tried an app, and that scanned it. It was a JotNot or something like that.
That JotNot Pro, that's the one I was going to recommend. You didn't get good results with that?
I didn't. Not with the 3GS.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It's just not good enough of a camera. On the other hand, on the iPhone 4, it really does an excellent job.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm kind of leaning towards the Galaxy then.
I think if you have any images you need to get in there, there's really pretty much no choice.
There's no choice.
Yeah. Except for an iPhone, maybe.
Or an iPhone.
Yeah.
It's way too small. Maybe.
I think that probably is not a good choice for you. Yeah, you know what's nice is 7 inches is right in between. You know, it's not as big as the iPad, but it's bigger. It's big enough, I think. It's big enough. JotNot Pro, you should take a look at, folks, if you want to get, if you're, say, in a library doing research, you want to take pictures, it really does a great job. It doesn't do any OCR. That is, it doesn't turn the picture of the document into text. But it does get a very, very high quality image that it can then kind of take the color out of. It makes it very legible. It's a good way to take notes. And it will then go into Evernote. Evernote is really the application for saving this kind of stuff, I think. It's free and it's just fantastic. But it will also save to a library. You can fax it, send it to Google Docs, or send it to an iDisk. JotNot Pro. Nice little app. But Anthony didn't like it. So there. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. Our website is techguylabs.com. You can go there and get all the notes. Every time I talk about something, we have a great guy, James DeRuvo, who's just there scribbling, writing it all down. And he'll put that on the show notes. You can get it. This is episode 723. I was going to tell Anthony about, but I decided not to because it sounded like he doesn't want a laptop. But an alternative to the MacBook Air is the Acer Timeline. Very thin, very fast. Also fairly expensive. It's not a netbook, but a very good lightweight laptop. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Which one? Whoever spot?
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Okay, one more travel tip. Dick DiBartolo, he travels a lot, like SeatGuru.com. I'm on SeatExpert.com. Before I book on a flight, I like to see where my seat is. And at SeatExpert.com, I'm actually looking at the map of this particular plane that I am on. In this case, a 747. And it'll say things like, oh, you don't want this one, reduce storage space. Oh, don't want that one, heavy traffic area. It actually tells you things. So you can say, I think I'll be on this one. Increased leg room and layout allows easy aisle access.
That's very good. Isn't that cool? Yeah, some seats will say you can hear the toilet flush.
Yeah, you don't want that.
Right behind you, so you know you don't want
this. This is like 13A on this plane. Heavy traffic area, close to restrooms, obstructed window view. Not good. You don't want that one. Hey, that guy right there, that guy, that's Dick DiBartolo. He's Mad Magazine's maddest writer. And the Gizwiz. He does a daily podcast with me called The Daily Gizwiz. It's a kind of clever name.
Oh, it's amazing. You came up with that.
Yeah. Let's see, it's every day, and you're the Gizwiz, so what if we call it the weekly Gizwiz? And then it was you who said, well, you know.
Yeah, I guess I did. I jumped in and said, you know, Leah, that's a really, really great title, but if we just modified it a touch to daily, ooh, and then you thought about it, then you called Jen. And Jen
I had
said,
asked
yeah,
my wife,
with,
yeah. Because yeah, before go I do anything, I ask my wife.
Go with what Dick said.
That's yeah, how I've exactly been married 20 years. You ask your wife. And when the other one is, when she asks you, you say, yes, dear. Yes, dear. Dick
I
is,
say that to you all the time.
Yes, dear. No, you don't. So yeah. Dick joins us every week at this time to talk a little bit about some funky gadget. Are you going to go to next month is CES, the Consumer Electronics Show. Are you going to be out there for that?
Yes, dear.
Me too.
Yeah, no, we're doing, we already made a plan. We're doing some gizwizzes at Showstoppers.
Oh.
You know, I'll find gadgets and then you'll run over for, you know,
with
10
the camera
minutes
and we'll do that. And then let's do the radio show. I'm going to do the radio show from CES. This is the Consumer Electronics Show is once a year in Las Vegas. Huge. And it's where they show stuff that's going to be out usually not next month, but later in the year. For instance, that Pan Digital that I just panned last hour, right, saw that at CES in January, and it finally came out around November. So that's sometimes it never comes out. You see stuff that never comes out.
That is correct. But you want to know something, Leo?
What?
I have a Pan Digital, and I use it.
You like
as
the
my
frame?
Video. I use it as a video player.
Oh.
The ebook reader has an SD card slot, and I copy dozens of movies to it, and then I just use it as a 7-inch. Video player no, down at the boat.
It isn't a capacitance screen. It's a resistance screen, I think. So you have to use a stylus.
Yes. Or you have to hit it hard. It's not glamorous like the iPhone.
You have to hit it hard.
Yeah, you know, it tells you in the book, like, more use your nail than your finger.
That's something. But if you're going to get a tablet or even a smartphone, folks, ask, very simple, capacitance screen. That's what you want. That's what all the good ones are. Resistive is the old form of touchscreen, not so good.
Yeah. That's, well, you run that website, Pad Guru, where it tells you where exactly.
You should. That's a good idea. So what do you got for us this week?
You know, I have a real quickie. It's an update of, and especially with Christmas coming, it's the update of the Open It, which is the way to open Christmas gifts, get Christmas gifts ready to be played with. Because it almost looks like a pair of gardening shears, so it can cut through wires. You know, these days things are wired in place. Then if it's a kid's toy, there's the battery compartment is screwed closed. So one arm of this device has a little screwdriver in it, so you can open the battery compartment. There's a slide out box cutter, so you can cut through cellophane and shipping labels. The cutting head is on an angle so that as you cut through thick plastic, the plastic doesn't come at you and cut your fingers. Sells for anywhere from $11 to $13. And if you don't need, and they added a bottle opener. I don't know why I need a bottle opener, but the new 5-in-1 has a bottle opener, but the old 4-in-1, you can normally get them at discounts. It's a little clunkier. The screwdriver is not as convenient, but either model is very good. The old one is called the Open It 4-in-1, and the new model is the Open It 5-in-1, and all over the place on Amazon.com.
Must have for this holiday season.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually, it is a good stocking stuffer.
No, it's perfect. Yeah. It's perfect.
Give him that, and then give him a bunch of stuff in blister packs. Say, exactly. See? See, 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 see.
Wrap it up in scotch, you know, scotch. Lots of tape. Now let's see you.
Dick's website is gizwiz.biz. That's where you can play the What the Heck Is It contest, a close-up picture of a gadget or gizmo. And if you get it right, or if you come up with the most creative answer, he gives away 36 Mad magazines every time. Gizwiz.biz. Thank you, Dick.
Thank you, and I'll see you shortly.
Yeah, because we're going to do our show in a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So don't go anywhere. You stay right there. Did you, Kyle, want me to do anything here at all? A billboard, an ad, anything at all? Just anything at all? I'm good to go? Okay, well, in that case, let me take another call. Grant, Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Grant.
Leo, thank you for taking my call.
Of course. I think you might be the last one of the day.
Well, I know you're running out of time here, so I'll make it quick. I've learned a lot from your program. I appreciate it. So,
thank you.
I just picked up a new MacBook Pro 13-inch. Haven't used it at all, but I'm planning on using it a lot. So I'm a professional photographer, and I mostly film shooter up until fairly recently. I had an earlier MacBook, which has kind of run out of steam on me. So I'm interested in upgrading the MacBook with the hard drive and the RAM. So it'll take 8 gigs of RAM, which I'm prepared to put in.
You use Final Cut?
No, I'm a still shooter.
You're going to use Adobe Photoshop?
I got CS. I have CS5, which I haven't installed yet.
Yeah, Photoshop likes a lot of RAM. Eight's a ton.
I have some big files, so.
Oh yeah, if they're big, you're shooting 21 megapixels or more, that really can add up. And Photoshop, of course, with every scratch file, with every layer, adds a multiple of that. So more RAM's good.
I have a professional printer who does full foot by 5 foot high res prints for me, and they're 500 megabyte files usually. So.
Yeah, more memory is good.
The issue that I'm a little vague on is the hard drive. So it came with a 250 gig hard drive, and everybody's been talking about, especially for heavy Photoshop use, people seem to favor the solid state drives.
Yeah, makes a big difference with anything that hits the drive hard.
Yeah.
It makes a huge difference. For instance, boot times become seconds. My MacBook Air boots in 15 seconds.
Okay.
Application launches, and the Air does not have a fast processor. The application launches are literally less than a bounce. That's how we Mac people measure launch time, is how many times the icon bounces in the dock. I mean, it's literally less than a second to launch an application. And all of that is because nowadays, the processors, even the slowest processors, are usually pretty fast. It's the hard drive they spend a lot of time waiting for, and a solid-state drive has zero access time. You don't have to search for the data, and the reads are quite fast. Writes are pretty fast as well.
Now, what about real?
Here's the negative on solid-state. The capacities are much lower, and the costs are much higher. The cost per gigabyte is much, much higher.
Well, now, what? There's some of the more conservative people I know kind of questioning the reliability of the solid-state drive?
No, wouldn't worry about that. I think the reliability now is very good.
Okay.
The drives do some very interesting tricks to keep themselves from wearing out. The ideal situation, if you were using a desktop, would be have a boot drive and an application drive that were a solid-state, and then mechanical drives, spinning, the normal spinning drives for data storage, because they're a lot cheaper.
Be doing early next year when I get some more money.
Yeah. And even on a laptop, it's not a bad idea. What I do on the MacBook Air, I only have 64 gigs in there, is I have Lightroom on there. And I don't have Photoshop, but I use Lightroom on there. And I use an external drive for all the storage.
That's what I do.
Yeah. So then in that case, a solid state drive makes a lot of sense.
Okay. I basically use my laptop just for working on stuff. And then as soon as, like with photographs, as soon as the photographs are done, they get transferred.
You move it right off.
External.
So the smaller storage won't bother you. The cost per gigabyte, you're a pro. This is one of your primary tools. So you're going to spend some money, and you're willing to spend money. I think a solid state drive makes a huge difference. Highly recommend them. I use a Corsair on my MacBook Pro, and it makes it's a fantastic thing. If you can find one with the SandForce controller, that's the one you want to use. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.